I'm Ed the Sock, and this is FU Politics on Fun, the FU Network, powered by your support on patreon.com/FUNetworkTV and through PayPal at FUNetworkTV@gmail.com.
Well, hello, Stephen.
Hello, Stephen. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well. What is this, week 40-11th of the lockdown?
I have zero idea. I've lost track of time. I've come so far around. Like, for a while, I lost track of what day of the week it was because it really wasn't relevant. And then it started to become relevant again. Like, I'm starting to, because I have things I have to do on certain days, so I'm starting to recognize again that there are actual names before the word day. Before, it was all just, what day is it? Day. There was day and there was night, and that was about it. But, I mean, York Region is opening up next week. Sections of Ontario are being opened. So maybe we're through the first part of the worst of the first part of this pandemic. I mean, there's those who say it's going to come back and come back stronger, but I can't believe people who don't really know from day to day what's going on, because it's confusing. You know, it's new information is constantly coming to the fore.
I think it was Yogi Berra who said it's really hard to make predictions about the future.
Oh, Yogi Berra. Nobody goes there anymore. It's too busy.
Well, see, I know what day it is because Monday's the only day that the liquor stores aren't open. So, you know, gives you an idea where my priorities are these days.
Well, I see how you're spending your shutdown. So let's talk today about, I mean, this is not a new issue. It's just been given a new boost, which is, I don't know if this falls under cancel culture or what, but this whole, the whole idea about rethinking some of the statues we have to people, rethinking some of the monuments or streets or anything else that are named for certain people who have, let's just say, a checkered past or a terrible past. And that focused last week here in Toronto on Dundas Street, which is a major street in downtown Toronto. And it was named for somebody who was, you gave a very good history of him. So why don't
I was curious because, I didn't know myself sort of what the history, I was sort of vaguely aware that, you know, he was a British politician and Dundas, Ontario is named after him as well. It's someone by the name of Henry Dundas, who was the Viscount Melville, and he was a British politician. And, to back up a little bit, of course, you know, this is sort of a little bit of spillover from the United States, where, you know, obviously, you know, the Confederacy is very much in the news these days, 160 years later, with all of the monuments that are coming down, the state capital in Kentucky, in Louisville, Kentucky, or is it Frankfort? But whatever.
You can say whatever. No one's going to. Very few people are going to know.
I've got some friends in Kentucky, so you know they'll call me on it. Anyway, the state capital of Kentucky, took down a statue of Jefferson Davis, the president of the Confederate States of America, and it is just one of. It's hard to judge, but reliable numbers kind of put it at 1,800 different monuments, statues, memorials to the Confederacy around the United States.
Isn't it? Because he was a traitor to the United States.
Absolutely. He waged war on the United States.
Yeah, he caused, he caused massive casualties.
Robert E. Lee and, all these iconic figures of the Confederacy. I mean, they were traitors who were fighting for the cause of slavery. You know, it wasn't the state's rights. Yeah, but it was the state's right to have slaves. So
that's, well, it's like the Germans don't have statues to Hitler.
No. Not the last time I was there. I didn't see
it. Not that I'm necessarily comparing Robert E. Lee and those people to Hitler, but they do have a past that where they fought very hard and killed lots of Northern American boys in order to try to preserve slavery. So they're unsavory individuals.
And not just to preserve it, but also extend it out to new states in the United States. I mean, part of the Civil War was about the new territories and whether they were going to be slave states or free states. And one of the things is they wanted them to be slave states, for obvious reasons. And their economy was based, built on slavery. We talked about that, the end of end of the Civil War, there were about 4.5 million slaves in the United States. The economy was based on that. So it's really, like you say, it's really odd that there are somewhere in the region of 1,800 statues and monuments to slavers up all over the United States. But the most telling thing is these aren't contemporary monuments. These weren't monuments that were put up before 1865. The statue of Jefferson Davis in the Kentucky State Capitol building was put up in 1936. And a lot of these statues were built and put up in, the...
Well, 1936 wasn't particularly enlightened.
No. Well, I'm sure someone's going to be looking back at our age and saying the same thing. But no, it wasn't. But at that time, things were going on in the United States. I mean, a lot of the Confederate statues that were put up sort of between about 1910 and the beginning of the Second World War. And they were put up by people who were trying to send a message. They weren't trying to commemorate their past and, white pride and all that kind of nonsense. They were putting up a message, a very visible message, to America's blacks who were, in the early stages of civil rights. And it was basically like, don't get too uppity, because, we still love these guys, and these guys knew how to treat a slave. And it was a real political message. It wasn't just, we're honoring history and, all this kind of stuff. It was a big public statement to America's black population.
Yeah. And Henry Dundas himself has, his history is somewhat inconsistent.
Well, it's a little more, everyone goes like, well, he has connections to slavery. And I'm like, well, slavery was actually pretty uncommon in early Canada. We talked about that in another podcast. I mean, Canada's, not that this isn't an excuse or anything else or to trivialize, but, we were not really big on slavery because it just didn't work for us for all kinds of reasons. Climate, our agriculture, all sure. of those sorts of things.
And the Underground Railroad came here and stopped here.
People came here to not be slaves mostly. But there was a history of slavery that goes back to New France, whether we were enslaving First Nations, Indigenous people, or later on blacks, mostly, who came up from the United States with the Loyalists after the American Revolution. But slavery wasn't that big. But so when I saw that Dundas had a connection to slavery, I was kind of like, wonder what it is. And just to kind of put him in time, he lived from 1742 to 1811, and he was, like most people, he was complex. He was controversial during his own time, but he held a lot of different, and he was a politician too. So it's really hard to judge people, especially really successful politicians, by what they say and even what they do. He was friends with John Graves Simcoe, who was the person who signed one of the earliest Emancipation Proclamations in the British Empire at the time. And he's the one who named Dundas Street and Dundas, Ontario, after Henry Dundas. But going back early, the funniest part of his life was, he was a lawyer in Scotland. He was a very powerful politician in Scotland, but he was also a lawyer. And in 1776, he represented a slave, a black slave named Joseph Knight, and actually won a ruling that confirmed that slavery was not possible in Scotland. You could not own a slave. Slavery did not exist in Scotland. So you think, okay, that sounds, for the 1776, pretty progressive. But then he became a very successful politician. He was, among other things, George III's Minister of War. He was the head of the British East India Company, which, deservedly has a bad rap, whether it's because of Pirates of the Caribbean or other popular views of it. I mean, they were a tool of imperial capitalism at its worst. So he was involved in all of these sorts of things. But in 1792, he was a member of parliament, a fairly powerful one. And Wilberforce, who was the driving force behind the abolitionist movement in England, was working very, very hard to abolish slavery on moral grounds all throughout the empire. And he introduced a bill into the House of Commons saying that slavery will be abolished in England. And what, as a real politician, Dundas added a friendly amendment to it, which wasn't that friendly, saying, including the word gradually. So Wilberforce's bill, which probably wouldn't have passed anyway, because it wasn't really the way the sentiment was going, was softened by saying that slavery will be gradually abolished in England. So, you know, gradually turned out to be 15 more years, because it came up several times. And, you know, in politics, they call it slow walking something. But, you know, you're saying, okay, yeah, this is important. But, you know, we got these other things that we got to do, and it's got to be done in a meticulous way, and we have to plan it and think it out. And remember, too, you know, in a historical context, 1792, France was starting its revolutionary wars. Before Napoleon. I mean, Napoleon was part of it, but it wasn't the Napoleonic period. But France was just tearing up and down Europe with its revolutionary wars. And England was one of the main opponents. And so England was in the middle of revolutionary war with France, which ended up becoming the Napoleonic Wars after Napoleon took power. And the British, and I think Dundas, was probably thinking, wow, this is not the time to be causing havoc in our colonies, which are providing us with money and all kinds of other resources that we need to fight the war. So we're going to leave slavery for another day, which they ended up doing. And, you know, they finally did pass abolition in 1807. But, you know, but even in 1792, Dundas was saying, my opinion has always been against the slave trade. It must be ultimately abolished, but by moderate measures. And so I say it did happen, but he is remembered. And this is where the slavery and the objection to the name Dundas in Canada comes from, that, you know, it shouldn't be named after him, because he stood in the way of a more quick abolition of slavery in the British Empire. So what do you make of that?
Well, what I make of it is that he was a politician who really didn't have any particular, it seems to me, from reading the tea leaves of his history as you laid it out, he didn't really have any strong moral objection to slavery, but he knew many people did, and he knew that it wasn't a popular sentiment to say that you were, you know, standing for slavery and pro-slavery. So he did, he stood himself with his foot in, you know, each foot in a different stream. And on one hand, he was saying, yes, slavery should be abolished. On the other hand, he was saying, but slowly. Like, if you have a real moral objection to something, you want it gone. However, as I'm saying this, I'm realizing how politics actually works, which is that it's better to get a law passed which says that slavery will be abolished gradually than to have a bill which says slavery should be abolished immediately defeated and there be no roadmap whatsoever for getting rid of slavery. I mean, sometimes with public sentiment and stuff, you have to take things in slow steps. Not that I'm justifying slavery. I'm just looking at it and saying, well, what if he was a practical politician and he really wanted slavery removed, it's better to have a bill which says slavery should be removed and it's on a gradual, which is very vague, gradual. Gradual could have been 25 years, could have been 50 years. You know, turned out to be 15 years. But if you want to get something passed sometimes, you have to take less than you really wanted, rather than getting absolutely none of what you wanted.
Yeah, and like I say, you know, history is messy, and context in history is absolutely everything. And, you know, should he have been on the side of Wilberforce and the abolitionists from the beginning? Absolutely, he should have been. But, you know, he was a practical politician who said, you know, well, you know, we're making a lot of money at doing this. I mean, the empire is making a ton of money doing this, and we got a lot of powerful people who own plantations in Jamaica and other places, British colonies, and, you know, they're going to be unhappy, and there's forces against it. So, you know, we'll do this, but we'll, like I say, we'll slow walk it. You know, the net effect of it was, you know, over those 15 years, they estimated about another 500,000 people were brought into slavery. And of course, you know, the slaves that did exist in the British Empire, you know, they had to wait an extra 15 years of abuse and slavery in order to be freed. So, yeah, that is not a great legacy for anyone to be left with.
Agreed.
Whether you go and pull down all the signs and all the rest, you know, it's really hard to find heroes or even pure villains in history. And most people are a shade of gray.
Yeah, and my feeling is this, that a statue to this man, I would understand people objecting to there being a statue of this person because that does confer a sense of authority, a sense of honor. I don't know that I wouldn't oppose taking such a statue down, but what I would support maybe more is putting up a plaque that actually lists what this guy did. Because rather than at that point it being a statue which is honoring him, it's a statue which is actually drawing people in because they see a statue, and then they can read about the fact that we have a very we have a past that we shouldn't be too proud of. And I think that you take away the statue, then there's no opportunity for people to learn. I think that a statue being turned from an honor to a cautionary tale is something that I think benefits people more than just removing it. But when it comes to Dundas Street, I don't know if anybody really stops to think, who was Dundas? You think of it as the name of a street. It's tar, it's businesses along there, it's homes. Nobody really connects. I certainly didn't bother to connect that there was a Dundas. So if you're not connecting the person who you know about to the street, you're not really honoring him. It's not really an honor to have a street named after you when nobody knows that you were a person that existed and had a street named after him. To most people, Dundas is just the name of a street. It's nothing more.
Yeah, it's hard to be offended by something you know nothing about. I mean, today, would we pick him out for a statue or to name a street after him? Absolutely not. We wouldn't. Sensibilities have moved on, and that isn't the way we look at it. At the time, I mean, again, John Graves Simcoe, who is revered in Ontario in a lot of circles as being the person who was he was an enlightened lieutenant governor of Upper Canada and brought in the Emancipation Bill in 1793. That it was the first time that that slaves had been freed and put a cap on and he Simcoe slow walked slavery as well, because when Simcoe brought in the proclamation in 1793 to free the slaves in Upper Canada, he said, okay, no more new slaves, and we're going to phase out slavery over the next I think it was 15 years. When people turned 25, they stopped being slaves, and so everyone was kind of slow walking it then. In Simcoe, we have a Simcoe Day. I always find a great example of history being messy. I don't know if you've ever watched that terrible AMC docudrama called Turn about the American Revolutionary War. It's worth looking up. I mean, it's a real kind of Highlander America, but it's American. So of course the British Redcoats are all terrible people and all the rest during the American Revolutionary War. And the evil guy in it is a young captain by the name of John Graves Simcoe. And he plays like this drooling, crazy, red-coated, evil, shoot women and children, burn them in barns kind of person. And, I know that writers need a villain to move a plot forward. But you kind of look at it going like, wait a second, John Graves Simcoe, the one that we have Simcoe Day in Ontario named after, he's the American villain. So a lot of history is about where you are. I mean, Melville was Lord Melville, Henry Dundas was celebrated for his actions as I believe he was a Lord of the Admiralty and as Minister of War. In fighting off the French. I mean, that's what he was really known for. He wasn't really known much for the slavery stuff. He was an arch conservative, and liked the way the world was. But that's what, if you asked anyone at the time, that's what he would have been remembered for, and that's probably what John Graves Simcoe was remembering him for, because at that time, fighting the French was way more important than the slave issue.
Yeah, you go back far enough, you're going to find people that the attitudes of the times were, we've had a long road to get to where we are now, and we still have a road ahead of us as far as ending discrimination based on things, immutable characteristics or religion. But you go back then, and there were certain things that were just accepted, common accepted things. Like, if I was to look at every one of those people, I bet that they would be anti-Semites, because that was just the way it was back then. Would I want their streets renamed and so on because they were anti-Semites? No, I would actually prefer that there be some kind of plaque and some kind of information that indicates that they were, so that people recognize, you know what, Jews in Canada were subject to terrible anti-Semitism. So you could get a greater sense of what the various groups in this country had to endure in order to you know, eventually get beyond that. And that's educational. That's useful. And that's like I said, a cautionary tale. Use these people and their statues to show that we've had problems. And, you know, we still have problems to face. And do we want to have a statue go up or a street named after somebody nowadays, and in the future they discover that this person was a horrible person, was anti-gay or something? No, we wouldn't do that. And that kind of change would show that society has been evolving, that we wouldn't give statues to people with those attitudes. This is living history, in a sense. And tearing stuff down does nothing. It doesn't inform. It doesn't educate. It doesn't change the pain of what people went through. In fact, I think that it's kind of thumbing the nose. It's taking a Band-Aid approach instead of putting it right out there. And here's a statue. And who was this guy? Oh, he was a slaver. That's important to know. It stops being a tribute to the person. And it's, in fact, a notification of what we've done in the past and a recognition that we still have a ways to go.
Yeah,
I just don't understand. Yeah, I don't understand this business. Tear it down makes it like the person was never there. The person didn't exist. When you've got it there, at least you've got people asking questions.
Yeah, like I say, as they say, it's like it's a learning opportunity. And there's a story that came to mind. I remember I was practicing law back in 1990, and it was the centenary of the first woman who was a Canadian to become a lawyer in the British Empire. First one in Canada, and certainly the first one in the British Empire. Her name was Clara Brett Martin, and I remember the Law Society of Ontario, well, it was Law Society of Upper Canada back then, it's now the Law Society of Ontario, was getting all sort of giggly and beside itself about doing a big presentation of her work and this pioneering feminist, and isn't this wonderful, women advancing, you know, through a moss-bound profession like law early on, and what a great example she was. And then I think it was the archivist at the Law Society of Ontario said, have you read her letters? And you know, Camille went like, why? What? We're going to get her picture up on some banners and, you know, do the whole thing at Osgoode Hall. And they said, well, she was a terrible anti-Semite. It's like, wait a second. So here's this pioneering feminist who hated Jews. And it's like, well, what are we supposed to do with that? It's just people are complex. I say it's because someone's a hero in one area doesn't mean that they're villain that they're not a villain somewhere else, and vice versa.
You know, as a Jew, I would prefer there be a proper reckoning about this woman. Yes, she was the first lawyer, and that's laudable. And it's important for people to know that somebody who gained that prominence was still very publicly an anti-Semite, and could achieve what she achieved, that it wasn't a disincentive. Whereas nowadays it would be no contest. No, if you're found to harbor these views and have expressed these views, you don't get the honors. But I don't want history to be gone away. I don't want history to go away. I would rather there be a monument to, Mackenzie King, who sent the Jews back, in the boat to be killed in Europe during the Holocaust. I'd rather there was a monument there and explained that he did this, because I think people could learn from the fact that it was within living memory that Canada was so anti-Semitic that they would prefer to send people back to be slaughtered rather than have them in their country. Because I think that's important when we start getting up on, you know, people's anti-immigrant senses start rising. It's important for people to recognize, well, look what happened last time we did that.
Yep.
You know, or one of the last times that we did that, that people went back and they were annihilated. They were tortured and annihilated. Do you really want that to happen? And I think that's an important part of our history that needs to be taught, that needs to be understood. And whatever good Mackenzie King did, this is a stink that sits around him and will forever. You know, the none is too many policy about Jews during World War II. We need to understand that as a country. We don't, our knowledge of our country, our history is so shallow that, first of all, we don't recognize what we were and what our attitudes were as Canadians and what the prevailing sentiments were. And because of that, we also can't recognize how far we have come from those sentiments. So we have no ability to really rationalize how much we've progressed in, and I would say that we've taken rather large leaps in my lifetime in acceptance. It's been rather startling, and in a positive way, I remember it was during my teens and early 20s when it was still common for people to be complaining about multiculturalism, saying it was going to destroy Canada. Now you find it's a rump of people that would still say that. Now most people recognize that multiculturalism was a huge boon to Canada. Yep. And a lot of the people who are here now, a lot of Canadians, are people who are here because of the multiculturalism policy. You know, their parents came here, their grandparents, and they were born here. So it's important that we get a sense of context in our history, and making things just go away, that's, I think, what has been going on in the U.S. for too long with regards to how they treat their Black population. And it doesn't go away. It goes away and it's out of view, but the emotions, the feelings, the hurt is still there, and it festers. And when you don't talk about something, it festers. Content under pressure will explode. And we're seeing that happening in the United States now. And that's because, before phone cameras, we had to take the police's point of view or their word for it on how a arrest took place that involved violence or perhaps death. And because they were police and they were authority, and we're supposed to respect them, we usually took their word over other people. Now we have video that shows that, no.
Sometimes it ain't so.
Yeah, they've been doing wrong. And it's important for us to recognize that for a long time, we were also letting things go swept under the rug because we were so willing to put our trust in people who were supposed to be able to trust. Now it's gone a little the other way, which is that don't trust any cops, which I don't believe in at all either. But it's important that we understand that this has been a process, that where we are today is part of a process, that we didn't just all of a sudden become far less racist than we had been. We didn't become far more sensitive to the plight of Aboriginals, the plight of the homeless, and so on. It didn't just happen one day we woke up. That there was a gradual process that got us here. And it's important we look at every step of that process in order to truly understand the significance of where we are now, and also perhaps how we can go about continuing to make that journey to a place where we're continuing to reduce discrimination.
Exactly. Because sometimes the narrative, there's all kinds of memes about the racism narrative in the United States, which is, Lincoln freed the slaves in 1763 and they were all free. That's not true. And then, it came along, and then there were some people who sat at lunch counters or refused to sit at the back of the bus, and that moved it a little bit more. And then Martin Luther King came along, gave a speech, and there was no more racism. It's like, no, yeah. It's like, you got to understand, all the steps, all the steps backwards, all the nuance, all the forces pushing against it. Canada is interesting as a country because our formative years were mostly Victorian. And in some ways, I was talking to some English friends of mine that, Canada is still much more Victorian English than even England is in a lot of our names. And, we still have Victoria Day, where, the British don't have Victoria Day. A lot of our heroes are Victorian heroes, the heroes of imperial wars, colonial wars. We celebrated colonialism. I remember as a kid, it wasn't that, it's getting longer and longer ago, but I remember, a map of the British Empire. And I think it still said empire. It didn't say Commonwealth, on my public school wall, and seeing like a quarter of the world was in red. And everyone was proud of that because that was the march of civilization. That was the bringing of benign British influence across the earth and bringing democracy and freedom and all that other good stuff. Very simplistic narrative, but it was the narrative that everyone bought into, I'd say into the 1970s probably. So, we still have, Kitchener, Ontario. Kitchener was a celebrated British general, but, he fought in tons and tons of what now be considered imperialistic wars. There are people who are, Wellesley Street, Arthur Wellesley, the Duke of Wellington, the Iron Duke who fought Napoleon at Waterloo, not Victorian, a little bit earlier, but, Wellesley was a pretty terrible anti-Semite. He stood in the way of the emancipation and the enfranchisement of Jews in England, so they couldn't be full voting citizens and all the rest. Yeah, but he's remembered for beating Napoleon and saving the world from Bonapartism. And so, you know, we've got all kinds of stuff with, Wellesley or Wellington. You know, Toronto has both a Wellesley and a Wellington Street, because, you know, when you have two names, you get two streets.
Well, you know, I think maybe the only way to avoid any of this stuff is to go the American route and name our streets after numbers.
Well, I was in Brazil, and their capital, Brasilia, was designed. You know, they drew two lines in Brazil to the center of it and said, here's where we're going to put our new capital. It's the geographic center of it. And they built Brasilia, which became the capital. It's sort of like the way Ottawa was picked. And it was designed, you know, the city planner, the designer from scratch, was a communist. And he said, no names on any of the streets. All the ones going east-west are going to be lettered, and all the ones going north-south are going to be numbered, and that's going to be it. And, you know, it was a great experiment for a little while. Then everyone got tired of that, and they started naming stuff and going off-grid and all kinds of other stuff. You know, the sort of Soviet experiment of non-glorification of the personality, just, you know, it doesn't work. People want to have heroes. I mean, but heroes change. You know, I went to Jarvis Collegiate Institute, and Jarvis... on Jarvis Street in Toronto, Jarvis, an early citizen of Upper Canada, owned slaves. He was a slaver, and, you know, apparently a real jerk as a human being as well. Just on top of being a slave, he was just a real jerk. I had my tonsils out at Joseph Brant Hospital in Burlington. Joseph Brant, Chief Tyndaga of the Mohawks, he came back from the War of 1812 with 40 slaves. Actually, was it 1812 or one of the earlier ones? But anyway, he owned black slaves that he took as war booty from the Americans that he chased up and down Detroit. Do you do with people like that? I mean, those names are there, and, you know, they're associated with other things. But when you start to scratch the surface, it's like, oh, you know, their lives were not exactly fairy tales. I mean, you get a lot of good with a lot of bad, and it's just the human nature. So there's a risk in finding heroes, because the hero of today is not the hero of tomorrow. And if you look back, you know, you'll find out these people were people with complicated lives. I mean, I got a lot of my NDP friends mad at me this week because I was pointing out that Tommy Douglas wrote his MA thesis in 1933 on eugenics and praised eugenics, saying that this is great. You know, and he talks about the mentally defective, you know, should be sterilized because, you know, they're not like us, so they're not going to enjoy the joys of parenthood anyway, and they're not able to do it, and we're doing them all a favor. So we should be doing that to the mentally defective. And it's like, oh, that's kind of not the way you remember Tommy Douglas. And then people go, well, but when he was premier from 44 to, I think it was 71, he didn't do this stuff. Or 44 to 61. And he was party leader till 71. And he said, well, he didn't implement any of this stuff. Alberta had a eugenics law, a forced sterilization law. And so did BC. But when it came to Saskatchewan, Tommy Douglas said no to it. But it ignores the fact that forced sterilizations were still going on among Indigenous women all through that period. There just wasn't a law that was specifically in favor of it. But people change as well, and, you know, Tommy Douglas maybe felt differently about eugenics after World War II, and the rise of Hitler, and it's like, oh, okay, that's where it leads. Maybe this is not such a great idea. But people are complex.
Well, I mean, just my own political journey over my lifetime, I am not.
Oh, you used to be a terrible person.
I was a terrible person. I was very right wing, though for the times, what was considered right wing then now would not be considered right wing enough. But I was very much a conservative, and very conservative. And I've changed so substantially as I saw how life really is, rather than what, you know, spoiled son of, well, you know, lower middle class person living in a bit of a bubble thought the world, you know, how they thought the world worked. So, you know, I would not want to be held to the views that I held and the views I espoused all those years ago. I'm glad there was no internet, because there, because I have, there are numerous videos, because I did 3 hours of programming a week. There's numerous tapes out. Well, they're not out there. They're in my basement.
and there they will remain.
And that's where they'll stay, because the, you know, I've had them digitized just for posterity, just because I look at them and I cringe at, just to remember. And this is sort of what I've been saying. I look at them and I remember where the hell my head was at back then, and what I was thinking, and how far I've come. And it makes me recognize maybe there's still further I have to go when I realize how far, you know, how far away I am now from where I was. I can't believe this is the end of the journey. So
I know you're perfect as you are. Don't go changing.
Oh yes. Yeah. You and my wife both believe that. I do not. Though I think that she only says that. It's a complicated thing. And I think that we can't run away from our history. We shouldn't be cutting down, you know, taking down signs and changing street names willy-nilly. We should be informing people what they're about. And again, I really think there's a difference between a statue and a street. Because a statue, right away, you know, we're talking about an individual. A street name, I don't know how the names mean. A lot of street names are named after people who worked on the construction crew paving the area, or they're named after the developer and the developer's kids. And some of them may have been horrible people too. You know, where does it stop? I think a statue is a very different statement than the name of a street, especially when most people, to them, it's just a name of a street. It could be called, you know, Green Street or Brown Street or Third Street. They don't care. It's just an identifier as to where you are geographically. It's not something that, you know, you say, oh, I think of Dundas. I think of Henry Dundas when I, no one does. I mean, Spadina, I think it was originally pronounced Spadina. No one thinks about that. These are just, they're just markers for helping us get around the city and navigate where we are. They're not anything that really makes us think about these individuals. And maybe they should be. And maybe this discussion, this dialogue is important to have, because then that does get us recognizing we are better. And we always use the U.S. as a yardstick. Well, we're better than they are. And in so many ways we are, but that can't be the where you leave it. It's like people who say that, you know, marijuana is safer than alcohol and causes people to be violent far less. It doesn't cause. Okay. But it's marijuana intoxication is still not better than not being intoxicated. You know, and it's not something that has no dangers. It just has fewer immediate dangers. So you can't just say I'm better than X and therefore I am a perfected being or a perfected society. You have to say, okay, I'm better than they are, but we still have a ways to go too. We can't just pat ourselves on the back that we're better than the U.S. because the problem the U.S. has had, the reason that it's in the state that it's in my opinion, is that for too long kept patting itself on the back and telling itself that it was great, and telling itself that it was number one. So anybody who said, hey, our standards in education are falling, you hate America. Our people are further, you know, workers are falling further and further behind as far as purchasing power. You hate America. Like, there was no dialogue allowed. People were hushed. And we need to have these conversations here. We need to be aware of that who Dundas was. We need to be aware of what our history was and recognize that we were that. And in the future, we may look back, as you said, beginning of this program, people may look back on where we are now and say, look how primitive they were in so many social areas and so on. So we have to make the progress happen. So I would like it if people in the future look back and on our times now and said, look how foolish they were on a number of different counts. And because that means that we've progressed to a better place.
You know, and you know, because Canada is a colonial history, you know, it's really, really difficult, particularly in Canada, to divorce ourselves from that history. Take Sir Johnny Macdonald as an example. I mean, I think he's a much tougher problem when it comes to statues than someone like Dundas, because John A. Macdonald is Canada. I mean, he was the driving force behind Confederation. He was the first prime minister and shaped the early part of this country for a long, long, long time. And, you know, he had this absolutely terrible reputation, well-deserved, with the way he treated Indigenous people. I mean, we always say, okay, history, you can't judge people by today's standards.
Yeah.
You know, like Canadian, you know, we're all woke and we're all, you know, we're all kumbaya and all the rest of the stuff. And so you can't judge Sir John A. Macdonald, you know, in the 1850s by the same standard, but by the standard of his own time. And, you know, this is from early times to basically his death. He was considered by contemporaries to be outstandingly racist for his time when it came to the, you know, what was then called the Indian question. You know, his policies, I mean, whether it was, you know, Riel and the Métis or the clearances of land or the, you know, just generally, you know, the policy of moving along and sometimes outright extermination. It's really, really tough when you have someone who is the father of Confederation, who's so intimately tied up in the history and founding of Canada, who was a terrible racist. So what do you do? I mean, one side is very clear. It says, like, well, we don't celebrate him. I mean, we use him as proof and to acknowledge that Canada has a racist past and still has reverberations of racism that goes right to today, with, you know, right to, you know, last week with Chief Alan Adams in Alberta being tackled by the RCMP for no apparent reason.
I heard there was reason. He wanted to drive, and they're not allowed to let him drive with expired plates, and he kept insisting he was going to drive his car. Now, what you know transpired with the use of force is a different story. But he wasn't completely without blame in the circumstance he found himself in, as far as being questioned by police. So, but we're just so quick now to not allow ourselves to say, well, an Indigenous person may have contributed to a situation. Doesn't excuse when excessive police force was used, though. My understanding is that in this case, it wasn't excessive. It was the kind that's prescribed by training for that circumstance. Mm. And it looked
a little excessive to me.
Well, but the thing is, to us it does. And it may very well have been. It may well be that the regulations need changing. Mm-hmm.
But there, you know, there is this long, long, long history of institutional racism when it comes to policing and Indigenous people. I mean, you know, certainly in Alberta, certainly in Saskatchewan, Manitoba. I mean, wherever there are, you know, sort of large Indigenous populations and local police forces. I mean, you go to Northern Alberta, and my God, you know, the way it is pretty unpleasant up there. These are reverberations that continue down from sort of the view that Canada has of itself and, you know, sort of how we've shunted that question off. And so statues of Sir John A. Macdonald, I can see those being incredibly offensive to Indigenous people, because he represents, you know, a lot of bad things that happened to them early on. You know, he created Canada, which, you know, if you're a white middle-class person, is a good thing, because, you know, we're enjoying the benefits of it, and Canada in the community of nations is a great nation. However, we've got our problems, and the way we've handled, you know, we've treated our Indigenous people has been, you know, one of our lasting shames.
I agree. And, you know, the thing about Sir John A. Macdonald, and I did some research on this, is that while he was racist against Indians, he was actually somewhat enlightened at the time, because he was of the move them, don't kill them, you know, movement, as opposed to a lot of people who were just about, you know, like in the States, try to just wipe them out. And that's not enlightened, and it's certainly not acceptable, and not something we should be, you know, we should be celebrating, because I'm sure that at the time, even though the general sentiment was against natives, there were people who were enlightened and who, you know, if it was possible to be enlightened back then and to be more interested in the salvation of native people, then it was possible for politicians to do so too. So doesn't let them off the hook just because prevailing sentiment was X. I mean, your leaders are supposed to lead, not follow. Yeah. And, but again, it's problematic, because you can't take away from him that he created Canada. But I think what we do is, rather than that tendency we have to lionize people as either a hero or you know, make them completely villainous, we need to look at people as whole people. You know, I think we need to stop this tendency we have towards they're either a hero or a villain. They can be a bit of both. And I think that, you know, it's interesting that the Old Testament, if you look at the patriarchs, none of them were perfect. They all had errors. They all had human failings. And they're there as a lesson that, you know, this is the human condition. And we need to start thinking about people from our past as, yes, they did some good things. We need to look at the things they did that were bad. Look at the person in total as to what their contribution was and what the merits they have as well. Because this business of hero versus villain is such a juvenile concept. It works fine in the Avengers movies and in comic books and, you know, some TV shows, but it doesn't work well in life because really, as you said earlier, very few people are either completely white or completely black hat. Most of us are shades of gray because we're just trying our best to get through what we're living in.
Yeah, and you know, it's important to understand and confront your past as well. I mean, and it can be very uncomfortable. I mean, you know, obviously, because you know, well, take Germany for example. You know, you said early on, like, you know, there aren't a lot of statues to Hitler out there. You know, they're in their proper place. They are in museums where they're placed in context and curated and explained. You know how this was. I mean, there is a Munich, which was the birthplace of Nazism, you know, has a controversial, you know, for locals, because you know there's certainly a generation that wants to forget it. There's a museum of the rise of the Nazi Party and Munich's place in all of that, and it's an education experience. And Germany does have all kinds of monuments. But they're all monuments to the evil of Nazism. I mean, if you go walk through, you know, both in Germany and in Austria and other places, there'll be cobblestones, and they're inscribed with the names of someone Jewish who lived nearby who was sent to the camps. And you know, you literally are confronted with history with every step. It's you know, there's still buildings in Berlin and elsewhere that, you know, the Nuremberg rallies, the stadium is still in Nuremberg. The site of the 36 Olympics, the Jesse Owens Olympics that Hitler hosted, you know, it's still mostly intact in and around Berlin. So there are these things there, but Germany has, you know, they didn't want to get rid of everything, because as soon as you get rid of everything, then you forget it. You know, unless you know you're on a field trip to a museum and you're forced to look at it. There's still things around that let people remember things. I remember when I was in Berlin, there's something called the Kaiser Wilhelm Memorial, also called the Gedächtniskirche, which is the Remembrance Church, which is was in the center of Old West Berlin, and it was a bombed out church from the First World War. That, I'm sorry, it was a bombed out church for the Second World War, because Berlin wasn't occupied in the First World War. And it was in the middle of Berlin as a stabilized war wreck to remind people of the horrors of war, because it's too easy to forget these things. You know, in Cambodia, you know, they went through Pol Pot, and they still have shrines all over the place full of skulls for, you know, when Pol Pot was busy. You know, with the killing fields,
yeah.
You know, the Cambodians, after they got rid of Pol Pot, they collected up the skulls of his victims and turned them into mountains of skulls in buildings. And they're dotted all over Cambodia where you can go and actually see that those all belong to people who are victims of these things. And yeah, but Cambodia's had reconciliation too, because people who were members of the Khmer Rouge are now in the government. And they finally said, you know, we've got to move forward. You know, we can't put everyone on trial. We can't point fingers forever. At some point, we got to move forward. And this is, you know, we're just going to say, okay, enough. We're now good. You know, that's now behind us. We understand it. We're just going to, you know, move on this.
Well, I think Germany is a great example of a country that will not forget its history, that will not let itself forget its history. I mean, what they have done in as far as anti-racism, I mean, it's taken in, you know, greater and lesser degrees, because they're human beings there, right? But they really do take their history seriously, because they don't want to repeat it. And I really give them credit for that. They really have done an excellent job of making sure that everyone recognizes what their historical legacy has been in order that they don't repeat it. And they have been great towards, I mean, they have really... not extinguished the specter of the Nazi past, because you can never do that. But as far as modern day Germany, they're very welcoming. You know, the government is very welcoming to immigrants, and you know, Angela Merkel has been very supportive of trying to get as many Syrian refugees into the country as possible. And they're very serious about not repeating the mistakes of the past. Yeah. So they've done. They're, you know, it's laudable what they've done. Whereas here, we don't even know our past. And that's a failure of many things. I mean, part of it is it's very hard to stand up to the deluge of the cultural deluge that we get from the U.S. I mean, they're huge. They're a global powerhouse of entertainment product, and their entertainment product is about themselves. And they overwhelm us with their history. And we go willingly, you know, no one's forcing us to watch these shows. They happen to be entertaining shows. And we don't have in Canada shows that speak to our history or are even to our present. We've never had a West Wing type show set in Ontario legislature or provincial legislature or the federal house. We've never had that. And those are things that it's a spoonful of sugar makes the medicine go down. You learn about the system while you're being entertained by the drama and the stories up front. We get that from the U.S., and it's very hard to fight that off. And it's hard to think. I mean, American history is full of revolution and brave heroes, and you know that we don't have anything to match it. And we're so honest in our history, in a sense that when I was being taught history in school, it was fairly boring. It was honest about what the people were. I did hear about the faults of some of these people, but it was boring and there were no heroes. Whereas you look at America, you got Davy Crockett and Daniel Boone and all these others. And, you know, George Washington, I cannot tell a lie. We don't have that stuff here. I think we're better off for it, but it also leaves us open to not really understanding how overwhelmed we are and how little we know about where we've come from, to use a sort of a compass point as to where we should be going next.
No, and I think that's fair. I mean, and you know, we all like to think of ourselves as better than we are. So you know, countries come up with these mythologies of all these great people. You know, and every once in a while, you know, there have been some good American documentaries on the founding fathers and sort of all the problems that they had too. But yeah, those aren't the ones that take root in the popular vision, you know, sort of Trump's version of America, you know, where, you know, in fact, 12 American presidents were slave owners. And, you know, I think it was 49%. Someone actually calculated it down to the 1%, 49% of the signers of the Declaration of Independence were slave owners as well. To talk about that uncomfortable truth is something that Americans just don't want to do. They want to hide behind stories of the Alamo and Washington crossing the Delaware and Fort Sumter and, you know, all of the sort of the popularized bits of history. When I travel in the United States, I remember being in Florida, you know, trying to learn about Florida history as a tourist, and, you know, good luck to you. I mean, it's like, no, Disney World is that way and, you know, beaches this way. And I was like, no, I really, you know, I was, my wife and I were down there on a holiday and we were really curious about Florida and during the Civil War, you know, what did Florida do during the Civil War? And, you know, it took forever. You know, we say, oh, is there a museum? It's like, no, there's no museum. I say, well, is there, you know, guidebooks or something? No. What do you want to know? I said, well, what did Florida do during the Civil War? And people look at you like, I'm not entirely sure. It's like, yeah. So it's, you know, I say, you know, history can be fascinating, but, you know, it can also be uncomfortable sometimes.
Well, absolutely. And sometimes discomfort is necessary. Like, you know, when you sit down on something and it feels like it's too hot, you get up because it was uncomfortable and you stop yourself from getting burned. And sometimes discomfort pushes us in the direction that we need to go that we wouldn't go if we had been comfortable. So yeah. It's, you know, we got to face the ugliness, you know, the heart of darkness in our own history. And we don't do that by making people and names go away. We do that by keeping the names there and informing what those names mean and who these people were and the fact that they were complex individuals. So we stop having this simplistic view of people as good or bad, because you're not going to find very much of that in the world.
Yeah. So the next time you're on Dundas Street and you look up and you go, wow, what a interesting, sometimes good, sometimes bad guy this was. You know, this is, you know, there's an interesting story behind this. And you and I, you know, we've worked in journalism. We're interested in stories. We're interested in people. And, you know, you hope that by doing that, you get insight into them and a little bit of insight into yourself.
Yeah. And I think if you make history interesting, lots of people are interested in the history of Canada. We just haven't had I mean, that's an area where it's a chicken or egg situation. Has our media failed us in not giving us that? Or has the media tried it and discovered that people aren't that interested because they got to make a buck in order to, you know, sell advertisement? So I don't know. I don't know where that problem is. I know that the problem, though, still exists. And until we really get a better sense of who we were, it's hard to really contextualize who we are. And maybe that's a place to close it for this week.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm not going to be going out and pulling down any statues particularly, but like you say, I'm all in favor of much more public education about, if someone's if a statue's up on a pedestal, you know, that thing's got four sides. Use all four sides to tell all parts of the story. And, educate people about what this person is, because the statue, like you said, it's up there because someone thought this person was a hero and worthy of emulation. And, you know, it's good to know the whole story about these things because that helps you understand who we are as a people.
Absolutely. And what we consider important, what our values are. So, Stephen, thank you very much again.
Hey, always a pleasure.
And thank you guys for listening. And we're still hoping that you'll help us out, keep this stuff going. We have equipment that needs repairing. We have people who would like to be paid, who've been working voluntarily for quite a while. There's a lot of things that we could really do. There's a lot of places we can go. There's a lot of conversations we can have. And I pride ourselves on the fact that our conversations are pundit-free, and there's no paid political people here. There's just people who are intelligent and interested and have informed opinions and share them. So help us do that. Help us buck the system, because that's what we're doing. We're bucking the system, and you can help that by giving us a few bucks. You can do it at Patreon. You can be a monthly subscriber at Patreon at patreon.com/FUNetworkTV, or you can give a one-time boost, which a number of you have done, and I really appreciate it. To PayPal, you send it to our email address, which is funetworktv@gmail.com. We have a goal. Our goal is to reach $2,000 on Patreon. Now, some people are listening saying, that's pathetic. You only want $2,000? And others are saying, that's a lot of money. But in the scheme of things, if you look at some of the other people who are building media in this country, they get, there's one I know that gets somewhere between $15,000 and $20,000 a month on Patreon. We're not looking for that. I mean, we'd love it. But right now, our goal is to reach $2,000 a month on Patreon. And we can get there if people give $1, $2, $5, whatever you can afford. We can get there, and that'll help us tremendously in keeping this stuff going and growing, and it'll help us eventually get to advertisers as well. So please help us out. We do this for you. We do it because we enjoy it, but we enjoy it because we enjoy, I think I speak for Stephen as well, bringing information and discussion about important issues to people in language they can understand and in a manner they can understand, and not with intense extra gravitas in order to make us feel like we're, you know, big shots. We talk like you because we are you, and we don't speak at you. We talk with you. So if you want to see that continue and grow and become a force in the Canadian media landscape, patreon.com/FUNetworkTV or on PayPal, FUNetworkTV@gmail.com. Thank you very much for that. Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you very much. We'll look forward to seeing you again next week.
And your mother should be very happy. We didn't swear this.
No, we didn't. Although, you know, I heard my mother drop a couple of bombs the other day. So I think COVID is starting to get to her too.
I hope it wasn't our shows that did that to her.
No.
All right. My best to your family, and we'll talk again next week.
And you too.
This is fun. The FU Network.